Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Mary, and I'll be hosting today's forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of Robert H. Hinckley and the Noble Foundation. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships here locally to all majors in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences in Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door to our office or to our website at www.hinckley.utah.edu for more information. The title of today's forum is Washington Update. Today's guest is Congressman Jason Chaffetz. Representative Jason Chaffetz is serving his third term representing Utah's 3rd District. He attended Brigham Young University on an athletic scholarship and was starting a place kicker on the BYU football team in 1988 and 1989. He still holds the BYU individual record for the most extra points attempted in a game, most extra points made in a game, and most consecutive extra points made in a game. During his college years, Chaffetz was a Democrat. But in 1990, he met Ronald Reagan and became a Republican. In 2004, Chaffetz was a campaign manager for Utah gubernatorial candidate John Huntsman. Huntsman won the race, and after he took office in 2005, Chaffetz became his chief of staff. In November of 2005, Chaffetz left to manage his own company, Maxterra Utah, a corporate communications and marketing company. In 2007, Chaffetz was appointed by Governor Huntsman as a trustee for Utah Valley University. He's also served as its president, a member of the Highland City Planning Commission, and as the chairman for the Utah National Guard Adjutant General Review. He was first elected in 2008 and is serving his third term. He's a chairman of the House Oversight Subcommittee on National Security and is also a member of the House Homeland Security and Judiciary Committees. Please join me in welcoming Congressman Chaffetz.
Thank you for having me here. A point of clarification, as I usually say, I need to make sure the record's straight. I was a place kicker. I was not an actual football player. It's funny because she named off some stats and whatnot. Those were some good fun times back when BYU used to score touchdowns. And we kicked an awful lot of extra points. And what's most important for a place kicker is we never lost a game by the margin of my missed kicks. Otherwise, you know, I'd be off, you know, living in Arizona or Wyoming or something. In fact, I remember watching the BYU place kicker, and I was at the BYU-Utah game, which didn't quite go the – it went pretty well for Kirk Jowers and the University of Utah, which he's never let me forget. But I saw these place kickers missing some field goals at some very critical moments, and, you know, you all probably saw that and thought, oh, and yet I watched that and I thought, now there's somebody who will never run for Congress, which in my position is something you got to look out for. So nevertheless, I'm very grateful to serve in the United States Congress. When I was your age and going through college, I never thought I'd be standing here doing this sort of thing. It was not part of my life plan. My mother had passed away from cancer back in 1995, and that was the same year that the Huntsman family had started the Huntsman Cancer Institute, and here was this family pouring hundreds of millions of dollars in to fight cancer, the disease that took my mother's life and ultimately took my father's as well just last year. And I just wanted to say thank you. I just wanted to say I appreciate it and asked for a little 10-minute meeting, which turned into a 30-minute meeting, which turned into, hey, why don't you come back next week? And about 6 weeks after my initial meeting, John Huntsman was kind enough to offer me a position to be his communications person on his gubernatorial campaign, which at the time there were 9 candidates. This is not a for sure thing going to happen as it looks now, but back then it was a lot less uncertain. It was a lot less certain. So after I joined the campaign and a few weeks after that, John Huntsman said, well, why don't you, you know, come join me. Congratulations, you're going to be the new campaign manager. And I said, whoa, time out, John, I've never done this before. And he said, oh, don't worry about it, I've never run for governor before. I thought that was interesting, and he was kind enough to let me be the campaign manager. He won. He invited me on to be his chief of staff, and I did that for another year, and it was a great experience, which I'm very grateful. It was a wonderful two-year ride and a great experience. And again, something I never expected to do. But for those of you that are engaged or like politics, I would just encourage you to be involved in any way, shape, or form. You have no idea where that's going to lead you. And we need good men and women who are involved in every step of the process, because so few people raise their hands, but those that do make a world of difference. So we're here to talk about a Washington update. So I'm now entering my third term. I just don't want to ever become one of those incumbents, but I have a little experience under my belt, and I want to try to share some perspectives on things that are happening and not happening in Washington. And then please, whatever questions you have, I'd much rather do as many questions and answers as possible. But let me hit on some of the big weighty topics that are out there. And then, like I said, we'll dive into any Q&A that you have. The biggest issue for me, at least from my perspective, that we have to deal with, and we got to walk and chew gum at the same time. There are lots of issues out there. But I really do believe if you don't get the federal government's budget under control, you can't do anything else. It impedes our ability to be self-sufficient. It impedes our ability to actually do the things and make the investments and make the federal government more effective, more efficient. Let me give you a sense. When I was running in 2008, right, not too long ago, that I was campaigning on the idea that our national debt was approaching $9 trillion. $9 trillion. Now, how much is a trillion, right? A trillion sounds like it's so big. You have a hard time getting your arms around it. If you spend $1 million a day, every day, it would take you almost 3,000 years to get to $1 trillion. That's how much money that is. So here we are approaching $9 trillion back in 2008. I'm sworn in 2009. At the end of this year, we're going to pass $17 trillion in debt. We spend more than $600 million a day in interest on that national debt. That's just the daily interest payment. And keep in mind, we got like record low interest rates. Imagine what we could do with that money. Think about this. The entire state of Utah, everything we do, from everything that happens at this university to the Highway Patrol to the National Guard to, I mean, you name it, right? UDOT, you know, the transportation stuff. We spend about $13 billion in a year. The federal government spends $10 billion a day. And then you look at the $600 million a day in interest. You just can't keep doing that. Since President Obama has taken office until now, there are 130,000 additional federal workers on the federal payroll. They're very expensive jobs. I mean, this very costly for the federal government. We have a federal budget about $3.6 trillion. And then if you look at the expenditures, for just personnel, it's about $450 billion just for personnel. So these numbers become so big and so massive and so out of control. We have just less than 3 million federal employees. You got to ask yourself, what are we getting in return for those taxes? Now, the classic discussion that's there in the Congress is, all right, so if you're going to tackle the debt and tackle the deficit, right, deficit is the annual number. The accumulation of all those annual numbers is the debt. If you're going to truly attack this, why don't you just raise taxes? And then the conservatives will say, well, let's just cut spending. And then some people will say, well, let's just do both. We'll cut taxes, or we'll raise taxes, and we'll cut spending. Well, we've raised taxes quite significantly now, by trillions of dollars over a 10-year span. What we haven't done is really make substantive cuts in spending. And the metric that I think is probably the most reasonable to look at is as a percentage of our gross domestic product. GDP is the accumulation of every financial transaction that happens in a country. Okay, so our and I'm taking some very some liberties and some very rough numbers, but the gross domestic product for the United States of America is roughly $16 trillion. So if you go back and you do the math and you kind of look at the way this all lays out, historically, over the last several decades, we have spent 18-19% of our gross domestic product. Sometimes it's come up close to 20%. During the World Wars, they would jump up closer to 25%, but then they would come right back down. But what's happened since I was elected, same time as President Obama, which is the time frame that I'm looking at, expenditures have gone up to 23% of our GDP. That is, the federal government is spending 23 cents out of every dollar spent in the United States of America. You can't sustain that, especially when your revenue is like 16% of the gross domestic product. So if your revenues are at 16 and your expenditures are 23, you got a problem. And that's why every single year we've had a trillion-plus dollar deficit has allowed this, plus that has grown this debt from roughly $9 trillion to going to be $17 trillion with no end in sight. Now, the way the process is supposed to work, it's not happened since I got there, and it's fundamentally wrong. And again, I don't want to be overly partisan, but I hope you can find that I'm being as objective as I possibly can. The first 2 years I was there, Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats were in control of the House. They didn't even pretend to do a budget. Didn't even pretend to do it. The United States Senate finally passed a budget after more than 4 years. See, remember that whole thing? Maybe you're not old, maybe you're too young. But we used to have a thing called Schoolhouse Rock. We had these little cartoons that come on morning. I'm Just a Bill on Capitol Hill. I see a couple smiles there. What's supposed to happen in the United States Congress is the president is supposed to present a budget. The president hasn't done that in a long time, so it's hard to gauge exactly where he wants to be. But the president is supposed to present a budget. At the same time, the House does a budget and the Senate is supposed to do a budget. Inevitably, they're going to be different. And so they set aside these rules and they come to a process where you can go through reconciliation and bring these two bills together and work out the differences. You know, I hear most people say, well, let's just compromise. Let's find common ground. I'm all for that. But if you don't pass a budget in your own body, you can't get to the reconciliation process. It's like if this woman and I were saying, we're going to negotiate out our differences, and she says, but I'm not even going to tell you what I'm asking for. How am I supposed to negotiate out the differences? And so we'll pretend in this little example here, sorry to pick on you, but if you're the United States Senate, under the control of Harry Reid since I've been there, this is the first time they passed the budget in 4 years. I can't negotiate with her if she won't even tell me what she wants. And the president, who was supposed to present his budget on February 4th, isn't doing that until April, after we've already passed our budget. So the Senate's supposed to pass a budget, House is supposed to pass a budget. We have passed one the last 2 years. I recognize the Democrats may not wholeheartedly like it, but when they don't pass a budget in the Senate, it's pretty hard to argue that they've got the high moral ground. The way that the government has operated is under a continuing resolution, which is the worst possible way to budget. Or is the worst possible way to actually move a government forward. So you're supposed to come together, get these two budgets, work out your differences, and then that is the framework by which the 13 appropriation bills will actually move through the process. 4 years going into my fifth year here, that's never happened. It hasn't happened once. And then we wonder why we have the financial problem that we have. Objectively as I can, 4 years in a row, the president did submit a budget. There is not a single person in the House or the Senate, Republican or Democrat, who has ever voted in favor of the president's budget. And I know there was a campaign, and I know there were a lot of discussion, but the naked reality is, in 4 years, the first 4 years of President Obama, he never got a single vote in favor of his plan. Not a single one. And yet, we talk to most people, they'll say, well, you know, let's do it with the president. You don't know what the president wants. You can't even get it. How bad is your budget if Nancy Pelosi won't even vote for it? Okay, she voted no on the president's budget. That's how bad it is. So here's the framework in which we're trying to get our financial situation under control. Now the Senate has finally introduced a budget. The president has been totally disengaged because he didn't even submit a budget. And hopefully we'll get to the point where now we can create this framework. That framework is the point at which you can then go through every Department of Defense, Department of Interior, and get more specific about what we fund and what we won't fund. This is the problem that is Washington, D.C. A lot of people, both sides of the aisle, have banked on the fact that most Americans don't care and don't understand how this process works. And that's fundamentally wrong. But I'm telling you, it is the most important thing to get a government that is functioning, that is bipartisan, that is cooperative. But if you don't go through that process, there's a saying in Washington that if you're talking process, you're losing. Because there's nobody going to be paying attention. It's not going to get on the nightly news. It's not going to be at the top of Drudge. It's not going to do anything. And that's what's been happening. But that has led to the financial woes that we have. And it's one of the biggest concerns that I have out there. There are other big, huge, weighty, massive problems and challenges out there. Getting jobs in our economy totally flows into the budget. And we can talk more in depth about that. A lot of news right now about immigration. Again, I don't want to sound overly partisan, but I have a problem with how the Congress is operated. When I defeated a 12-year incumbent Republican, in part on his position on immigration. And when I came to Congress, I met with John Boehner, and we talked about committee assignments. Now, I'm not an attorney, which in most town halls is like an applause line, but I'm not an attorney. But nevertheless, John Boehner asked that I serve on the Judiciary Committee. And part of the reason he said, oh, this would be good for you to serve on the Judiciary Committee is you're not an attorney. And I asked to be on the Immigration Subcommittee. In 2 years, now keep in mind, this is Nancy Pelosi's house at this point, we met for a grand total of 12 times. Once was to take a picture, which I didn't go to. Once was Stephen Colbert came and addressed, which, you know, everybody likes Stephen Colbert. I didn't go to that. Felt like that was a waste of Congress's time, as much as I like his program and been on his program and whatnot. They didn't address even a single bill, not a single one, regarding immigration. The president promised that he was going to tackle immigration in his first 12 months. Not his first term, his first 12 months. Never happened. So now I'll move forward to year five of time I've been there, and the president's been there. The president has been talking about immigration reform, but just a week before last, there was an article in Bloomberg. Senator Leahy, who's the Democratic chairman of the Senate committee, Senate Judiciary Committee, complained that the president has offered no specifics. And I would challenge you, I defy you, to tell me what the president believes should happen on immigration. Gives nice speeches, gives a nice, you know, outline. There is no plan from the White House. There is no specific piece of legislation that they're supportive. Now, there are 8 senators, 4 Democrats, 4 Republicans. I'm anxious in anticipating what they're going to put forward. I happen to believe that the best path forward on the immigration issue is to deal with this in a piecemeal type of approach. Unfortunately, over the course of time, there have been several attempts at so-called comprehensive immigration reform. Each of them right at the finish line has failed because they haven't had the votes. What I have suggested and a lot of my colleagues have suggested is let's take one issue at a time and pass those out. And some things are going to fail, but some things are going to pass. So I was committed at the very beginning. I said, look, I want to fix legal immigration. You never, ever solve this problem unless you fix legal immigration. I don't care how big, far, wide your fence is. If you don't fix legal immigration, you never solve the problem. And I believe that more wholeheartedly today than ever. Now, I just last week spent 3 days down working with the Border Patrol in Yuma and Nogales, Arizona, visiting with the ICE office there in Phoenix. like I said, I'm very committed to make sure we fix legal immigration. I was proud of the fact that last term, or last Congress, I actually introduced a bill that was the first bill in years to pass the House of Representatives in a very bipartisan way. Only 15 members of the House voted against it. But nearly 400 members of the House voted in favor of it. It didn't solve every problem, but it would have affected hundreds of thousands of lives. And at the heart of this debate, we got to remember, these are real people. Got real issues. It's not just some paper game we're playing here. We're talking about lives and kids and families. And this would have affected the per country caps. Right now, the law does not take into account proximity, nor does it take into account the size of the country. So, for instance, we treat Mexico exactly the same way we do Zambia. Mexico's got a bigger population. They got great proximity. We have a lot more familial ties here. Of course, the law should take that into account. India and China are much larger countries than Swaziland. But we have to take those things into account. The law currently doesn't. So this got rid of the per country caps. For instance, on the family-based visas, if you have a relative or a friend or whatever it might be, if you have a relative from Mexico, they're limited at only getting 7% of the available family-based visas. Well, that's kind of silly to suggest that Belgium's going to need 7%. And you keep going down the line, and pretty soon you figure out that too many countries, too many caps, can't solve the problem. So I actually passed a bill, and it moved forward, and then we passed a STEM bill. But again, the United States Senate didn't take up either bill. They didn't pass, but they passed the House, but didn't pass the Senate. My experience down on the border, and we can go deeper into this if you want, my experience down on the border is most of the things the people are talking about at the border are not the things you ever hear in Washington, D.C., nor do you ever read about in the media. I didn't find a parallel between the two. It's like, oh, yeah, that's what they're talking about. Not at all. And this is my second trip that I took. I spent 2 years ago, I spent 3 days down the border, same general area. Met with some of the same people. The problem's getting worse, not better. One of the big struggles that Secretary Napolitano is having as the head of Homeland Security, which is one of the other committees that I'm on, as well as the oversight committees, what are the metrics? You know, you have a lot of people say, well, we need to secure the border. All right. Okay. So we get everybody to nod their head and say, yeah, we need to secure the border. What does that mean? How do you gauge it? What are the metrics? So let me ask you a key question, because I promise you this will be right in the heart of the rage of the debate. They look at apprehensions on different sectors. So they parsed up the whole United States, and there are sectors everywhere around the United States. And they will routinely tell you that about half of the problem for the entire country is in the Tucson sector. Tucson sector goes from just west of Nogales over essentially to the border with New Mexico. They'll tell you that roughly half of the incursions into the United States happen in that sector. And Secretary Napolitano has been applauding the fact that the number of detentions, that is, somebody sneaks across the border, they get caught, that apprehension or that detention goes to statistically into the book, and she's been saying because the number of detentions has gone down, that means the border is more secure. So I ask you, and as I asked her and I asked Attorney General Holder, I said, if the number of detentions goes up, does that mean the border is more secure or less secure? Or if the number of detentions goes down, does that mean the border is more secure or less secure? Think about it, crime stats in your own city. If there are more people being caught for a particular crime, does that mean it's safer or does that mean it's not as safe? Don't know, do we? There are a lot of other statistics and things that come into play. The General Accounting Office, which is the essentially the auditor that we have, has come in to look at this and tried to put a term out there called operational control. Do we or do we not have operational control of our border? Right now, the answer is no. Less than half of the border has operational control. So even if they, in the next couple days, introduce a comprehensive immigration reform package, I think what you'll see, and I'm guessing, is a so-called trigger. This trigger is supposed to be the time that we have gained operational control of the border, and then some of these loosening of visas and whatnot would come into play. Don't know. I think one of the big questions that I have and the most members of Congress will have is, what is the trigger? How do you gauge it? What is the metric? And how do we deal with that? So, again, I want to touch on one other quick thing, and then, please, whatever questions. One of the topics that I see before Congress that affects every single American, at least as I see it, certainly the older, after you get past about the age 5, it starts affecting you, has to do with high-tech. The high-tech issues are really going to be paramount moving forward. As you really kind of digest what technology can do, it's a great thing. I mean, as long as technology is working, it can do amazing things. You all have grown up in a generation who, by and large, don't really go to the record store and buy records, even though they still call them records. Tower Records was a thing that Kirk Jowers used to go to every other day. He would just peruse all these Donnie Marie records. He was a huge fan. And still has that collection, by the way. You can ask him about it. But they've changed. And as we move to digital recording, as we've moved to smartphones that can tell you where you are, what you're doing, there are a number of issues that are going to come before the United States Congress. And let's keep in mind, Congress is a body who's not exactly technically savvy. I'm probably in the bottom 10-15% in terms of age. I remember when I first got to Congress, there was a member, their staff was a bit frustrated because they wanted to get BlackBerries. And so the member finally relented and said, all right, we'll get a BlackBerry. You could check it out if you're going to lunch. You could check it out. It's like, are you kidding me? Well, first of all, how many people still have a BlackBerry? second thing is, the idea that you would just check it out, it kind of misses the whole point of how it works. So we had a piece of legislation that came up, what was this, a year and a half ago or so, called SOPA and PIPA. Stop Online Piracy Act. PIPA was, I can't remember what the acronym PIPA stood for. It was the Senate version of SOPA. And it came before our committee. And it basically took a DNS redirect as the mechanism so to trigger a way if there's a bogus website or a website that was engaged in some piracy and pushed you off to somewhere else. It's what China does, okay? The government was basically you had a number of people, both sides of the aisle, sponsoring a bill that said, we want to have the same rules that China has, and we want to be able to redirect. So if this gentleman here is trying to access Pirate Bay to go, download a whole bunch of songs and that he's paying like a penny for, if that, he'd go to Pirate Bay, and the federal government would just be able to redirect him to some other site and basically cut off that transaction. Comes before the Congress, and I argued that, listen, you're about to perform surgery on the internet, and there is not a nerd in the room. You guys have no idea what you're doing with a DNS redirect, which actually makes the internet less secure and puts the government more in control of what you see and where you go. And we were ultimately able to defeat this. Now, technology can be a wonderful thing, but we're going to have to find these proper balances. There's an interesting intersection between the First Amendment, right, our ability for free speech, and the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment is our right to personal privacy, unreasonable search and seizure. We have the opportunity to be secure and not have the federal government or some other person following and watching us. But now that every person is carrying a device that has some sort of geolocation on it, it is not against the federal law currently for me or you or whatever to follow somebody else across state lines. You can go to Radio Shack or wherever you are and buy a little GPS device. You could pop it on the bottom of somebody's car and you can follow them. It's not against federal law. Now, there's a Supreme Court case called the Jones case. And what happened was law enforcement, I can't remember where it was, law enforcement had taken this hockey puck-sized device, popped it under a car, and they followed this person. The guy had committed crimes in the past. They thought he was a nefarious character, and they thought, oh, we'll just follow him, see what happens. Well, sure enough, he commits a crime. And so it was an interesting Supreme Court case because then it started moving through, and he said, that's an unreasonable search and seizure. You can't do that. Well, he ultimately prevailed. The court ruled 9-0 that the federal government, law enforcement, cannot simply follow you because they have the ability to follow you, that they're going to need a search warrant to do that. So I, along with Senator Wyden, a Democrat out of Oregon, have introduced it's called the Geolocation Privacy Surveillance Act. It basically says for both law enforcement and individuals, unless you have a search warrant, unless you have probable cause and go to a judge, you can't follow somebody else. And the example I like to use is a spurned lover who's maybe lives in Kansas City and the other person lives in St. Louis. Should she be able to follow him or him be able to follow her without her knowing? Absolutely not. There are voyeurism laws and certain things that are on the books, but geolocation is something that has not been out there. There's also Internet Radio Fairness Act, which I'm preparing to introduce, which deals with internet royalties. You got to ask yourself, I don't know how many of you, this will be interesting. How many of you have at some point or currently have a Pandora account? How many people have a Pandora account? It's amazing. All right. I love Pandora. You got to ask yourself, why aren't there more internet radio stations? There's Spotify. Okay. There's iHeartRadio. But there really aren't many others that are doing this. And the reason is, back in the 90s, early 90s, when they were coming up with these laws, most people were afraid, they didn't know how the internet was going to work, that you would just go online, push record, capture that stream, share the file with somebody else. This is back, you know, when you're dealing with some of the Napster and whatnot. And they created these weird laws. So, for instance, on the internet, it is against federal law, if you own a radio station, for you to broadcast on your radio station and then stream that content online, it is against the law for you to foreshadow what song's coming up. So Bruce Springsteen's got a new song coming up, and it'll be up in the next half hour. You are breaking federal law by doing that. This is the United States of America. It's the internet, for goodness sake. But that's against federal law. So you find is most radio stations will not stream their content verbatim on the internet. So you're at home, you're listening to the radio maybe over cable television. That's one set of royalties. You get in your car, maybe you're listening to satellite radio. That's a different set of royalties. Or maybe you're listening to traditional radio called terrestrial radio. That's a different set of royalties. And then when you get to work or at school, and you just got your smartphone and you want to listen to whatever streaming over the internet, different set of royalties. Now, it just so happens that the internet royalties are about 50% of revenue at Pandora. 50%. You can't sustain it. It should be like 1% or 2%. Interesting set of laws. I could go on. I get passionate and fired up about this. This, to me, I think is also an opportunity, quite frankly, for somebody like myself. I mean, look how many people raised their hand and said, yeah, I listened to this content. But there should be more competition. Right now, Pandora has 80% of the market share. They should be much more competitive. MTV, Rolling Stone, Yahoo, Microsoft, they all tried to get in this space, and they all had to leave because they couldn't stream the content they wanted to stream. They couldn't pay the royalties that are required. And it should be a much more competitive space. So we're going to do that. We also have legislation on patent trolls and all that kind of stuff. But I've talked way too long. Kirk made me talk longer than 10 minutes. But now I've talked way too long. So let's talk about whatever you want to talk about. And yes, way in the back there.
If you have a question, please speak clearly into the microphone and state your name and something about yourself.
My name is Zachary Reed. I'm a student here at the U. You mentioned continuing resolutions. Why is that so bad? Like, what about it makes it so bad?
Okay, great question. A continuing resolution is a budget process that basically says, we're just going to take what's already in place and just keep doing it. There's no ability to make any sort of adjustments. There are no amendments. In the process that's supposed to work, we do a budget. That's the framework and the dollars. Then we come back and bill by bill, there's 13 of the appropriation bills, they literally turn and read each page. And every member, when they get to page, 429 of the Department of Interior bill, can say, Madam Speaker, I have an amendment at the desk. They will read the amendment. You offer the amendment. Each member, I think, has 5 minutes to make their case. Additional members can do what's called strike the last word and make additional comments, and then we get to vote on it. Under a continuing resolution, they just say, we'll just keep going at the pace of $3.6 trillion. And by the way, we're going to have some other things that we're going to add in here. But don't worry about it. You don't need to see those. No amendments, no nothing. Here, you've got 48 hours and vote on it. And it's $3.6 trillion. And so it's just a terrible, awful way to go through the process. But continuing resolutions is how the House is operated in perpetuity, pretty much.
My name is Matt Marset. I'm a senior here at the U. Uh-huh. And my question involves the Sagebrush Rebels, uh-huh. the people who want to return, federal lands to the state and local control. Uh-huh. Do you believe that state governments should be trying to encroach on what was previously the domain of the federal government? And what's the state of Utah right to make a law trying to take back the land?
Yeah. Okay. Great question. So question has to deal with the lands. If you look at the makeup of Utah, about nearly 70% of our land in Utah is owned by the state and federal government. Well, most of it's the federal government. Problems with federal ownership of land. By and large, the way we collect taxes in order to educate our kids is through property tax. When the federal government owns this piece of property, there are no taxes. And so we have a very small tax base in which to have property taxes to educate our kids. So Utah has the lowest per pupil funding in the entire nation. We're dead last. The federal government, the deal when we set up the state of Utah is that we were supposed to be compensated as a state for all that federal land. So, for instance, if you're down in Garfield County, which is like Panguitch and whatnot, and a family of four comes out of California, and they go four-wheeling, and they get stuck or lost, they're hiking, and search and rescue's got to come take care of them from the county. Now, those people are volunteering their time, but it's very costly to engage in this type of thing. So we expect that Garfield County, we have 29 counties in Utah, we expect Garfield counties of the world to go out there and actually perform search and rescue, educate, help educate their kids, do all of these functions. And yet the federal government has not lived up to its deal, to its bargain, which was, we're going to compensate you for all this federal land. There is what's called PILT. It's a payment in lieu of taxes. And PILT payments are the things that go back to the counties to compensate them for all this federal, federal land. I haven't looked at it in a little while, but we're roughly getting just over 50 cents per acre for the year in the state of Utah. And according to the Utah Taxpayers Association, that means that they're valuing that an acre of land at 50 bucks. Now, how many of you would like to go buy some land in Utah for $50 an acre? I mean, it'd be a pretty good deal. Now, there are obviously some places, Bryce and Zion and Arches and those types, but we're not going to move those away from being a federally designated park. I'm not suggesting that. I don't support that. But the suggestion that maybe the state could do a better job of managing these lands than the federal government, I absolutely buy into. Should we do that for everything, including the examples I used? No, I'm not suggesting we do that. Now, I introduced a bill that said, for instance, let's go back and look at the BLM lands. Because remember, you got multiple different jurisdictions. You got Forest Service, you have national parks, you've got the, in this case, Bureau of Land Management. Back in 1997, under the Clinton administration, they did an assessment of the federal lands in Utah, just the BLM lands. And they found that roughly 1% of the BLM lands served no public purpose. That is, there wasn't a right-of-way, there weren't mineral rights, they weren't doing anything with the land. ends up being about 123,000 acres in Utah. So I introduced a bill to say, based on the Clinton administration's even own assessment of it, I know I'm a Republican, very conservative Republican, but even based on the Clinton administration assessment, it serves no public purpose. Certainly we can put that up for auction and sell that back. Here's what I think we should all be concerned about. The very premise, one of the core, when we founded this country, one of the core things we were trying to do is promote private ownership of land. That was the great promise of the United States of America. That's why when those people settled the colonies and we started to move to the West, people wanted land. And the idea and the opportunity for an American to actually own their own piece of land was part of the great promise of the United States of America. The problem I have is since the 1970s, that pendulum swung in the wrong direction. We spend, if you average it out, about $350 million a year acquiring private property and making it public. So if you go back to the 70s and look at now, the federal government has acquired more land than the entire state of Arizona. It used to be more than Florida. Now it's surpassed and gone bigger than I didn't realize that Arizona was bigger than Florida, but look at the map and look at the square mileage. That's a lot of land that used to be private is now public. And there are certainly places that we should have these designations. I'm not saying we should never do that. But your opportunity as an American or a Utahan to have private property ownership is greatly doing it. We have counties in Utah where more than 90% of their land is owned by the federal government. 90%. The bill put forward by Ken Ivory, the state representative who had this plan, is a legal strategy to force the government to come back and maybe allow state control of a lot of these lands. I think that is a superior model for most pieces of private property or most public pieces of property, because there's more recourse, there's more opportunity for you all to have input, and for people outside of Utah to suggest, "Oh, well, we don't care about it." I find that offensive. I think we can do that. So I think there's a balance between all this. But I do think the pendulum has swung far too much into the idea of acquiring public property. I think private property is a good, wholesome thing. A lot of good can be done with that. I do support the strategy that the state has been moving forward on, but not for every bit of land. Of course, we're going to protect some things. I will tell you, I'm working closely with Rob Bishop and Congressman Stewart on a lands proposal that would swap out a lot of lands. We aren't ready to introduce it yet. But I look for that in the next coming months. It's something we're anxious to do. Yes, this gentleman right here. Right. Oh, at least he started to. Did you?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Two rows behind you. Did you have one right there?
I have a question too.
Okay, go ahead. I'll be faster in my answers.
Okay. My name is Ryan Burningham. So I grew up in Provo. So thanks for your representation. My question is, I worked as a paralegal at a Social Security disability law firm for a year and a half, and it seemed like the system was pretty in need of reforms. It doesn't seem like there's a lot of political will to even touch the disability system. Can you comment briefly on that?
First of all, thanks for doing that. That's an important part of the process. The deep concern that I have that we should all be a bit worried about is if you look at disability claims, the fastest growing area there and within Social Security is those that are less than 40 years old, and the number of claims has gone from roughly 2% to more than 4% of our population. So in the last little while, and I don't remember the exact number of years, but it's a fairly short amount of years, the number of disability claims has more than doubled. Now, we want this to be there for those that are truly disabled, but I worry that some people are gaming the system. The fastest growing category, for instance, is the muscular skeletal category. People claiming that, you know, they stare at a computer screen or they're on the internet too much and, you know, now they can't work. I think there are very legitimate cases of this, but did we really double the number of people that can no longer work? or have a huge, massive portion of disability, it becomes very difficult for us to afford to do that. There is a lot of waste, fraud, and abuse. One other statistic, we're wrapping up here, and I'll get to this gentleman's question, but the federal government came out with its own assessment. This is the federal government assessing itself. They believe that in 1 year's time, they gave more than $100 billion in inappropriate and unwarranted cash to recipients, not just within Social Security, overall. $100 million, $100 billion in inappropriate payments. That's a lot of money. That's a lot of money. Yes, sir.
My name is Ola Matoa, and I'm a health society and policy major here on campus. And I was just wondering, what other legislations did we see authored from you that are to be coming up on the floor?
Oh, well, thank you. I think I've introduced 17 bills to date. If you go to thomas.gov, it has a listing of all of these. But everything from immigration reform, one other one that I'd highlight real quick that is a major problem in this country, and that is you're going to see a wave of states or of cities, counties, and I think eventually states want to claim bankruptcy. We saw Stockton, California. I offered a resolution that says, don't come running to the federal government. Federal government can't even pay for itself. Don't think that we're going to bail you out. Utah did the responsible thing, and that is with its retirement program moved to a defined contribution plan as opposed to a defined benefit plan. That allows us to be financially solvent and balance our budgets. Illinois, California, New York, Kansas is one of the worst. So they're going to hit the whole gambit.
I have four principles: fiscal discipline, limited government, accountability, and a strong national defense. If it falls within four of those buckets, one of those four buckets, that's where I like to spend a lot of my time. The other thing that I will suggest that you'll see from me that you won't see from most others, I think the federal government has a duty, role, and responsibility to deal with the prison. I've been working on prison reform. Nobody ever wins or loses an election based on prison reform, but I'm spending a lot of time on that. We're getting ready to introduce one because there have got millions of people incarcerated, and we truly need to change that. So, and relook at how we do it. 25% of the Department of Justice budget is spent on the Bureau of Prisons. When's the last time you read an article about the Bureau of Prisons? Oh, sorry. I think I'd probably kick the plug back there. Listen, it's an honor and privilege to be here. My son goes to the University of Utah. He's on a mission right now. He's off in Ghana, Africa. But he spent his first semester here, and he looks forward to coming back and being a Ute. And other than game day, I'm totally good with that. So I appreciate it. This is the most important research university we have in our state. It's a feather in our cap. It's an honor for me to be here. I wish you all the best in what you're doing. Please be involved and engaged in every step of the way. We need more good people. So thanks for having me here today. I do appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you.